You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Hi, just a couple of housekeeping notes before we start. Although the Second City's live theater and live classes are not happening, we have turned everything virtual. You can take Second City classes in writing, in improv, and acting. There's a kids camp. We're also doing virtual corporate webinars and keynotes and workshops. It's all really kind of amazing, everything that we've been able to turn around. Plus, Second City is offering live improv shows on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You can get all that information at www.secondcity.com. Check it out. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Jacqueline Novogratz. Jacqueline is the founder and CEO of Acumen, a global community changing the way the world tackles poverty. She is the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Blue Sweater, and has been named one of the top 100 global thinkers by Foreign Policy, one of the 25 smartest people of the decade by The Daily Beast, and one of the world's 100 greatest living business minds by Forbes. She has a new book. It's called Manifesto for a Moral Revolution, Practices to Build a Better World. Jacqueline Novogratz, welcome to the show.
I'm so excited to be here. Thanks so much, Kelly.
So let's do just a quick check-in. This is what we do during the global pandemic, even though some people are acting like that's not happening anymore. How are you? Where are you?
I'm fine. I'm definitely aware that many people across this country and in the world are not fine.
Yep.
And I'm outside New York for a reprieve. I've been in New York in the city for most of the pandemic, but now I'm outside on Long Island.
I was just talking to some new business acquaintances who live in New York who, because they went through the experience of hearing ambulances every 5 seconds, right? And they lived inside that. She said the behavior around her is just keenly like, no, this is a real thing and we have to be careful and I'm not going to eat in a restaurant.
Fascinating. I haven't eaten in a restaurant either, actually. No. And I think you're right. The ambulances, the health workers, the great sense of citizenship and patriotism, if you will, of getting up on your roof at 7 p.m. every night and seeing all your neighbors and a belief in community, which really flies in the face of so much of the individualism we're seeing around. So I think New Yorkers, in a funny way, are holding those tensions of individual and community in a deep way. And I think it's worked for them.
With almost every interview I've done in the last, 6 or 7 weeks, before I crack open the book, I get a little worried for the author of like, when they wrote this, they did not know. Now, but I think the timing of the publication of this book is somehow oddly prophetic because we are living in times that are dangerous and beautiful, seemingly hopeless, and yet you can find rays of light if you know where to look. And you write near the end of the book, quote, "When you are broken or exhausted, and you will be, remember beauty, gratitude, faith, and love. Remember in the struggle, there is beauty that endures. Remember there will be beauty in moments of tragedy, as well as times of shared celebration. But most important, remember that beauty is inside of you if you let it be."
Yeah, when I started this book, Kelly, I wanted to pass forward what I have learned from so many of the change agents and entrepreneurs with whom I've worked for the last 35 years, I feel a deep and growing urgency that I might not finish the work I came to Earth to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm very cognizant that that work is the same, but it takes different forms in a world that has changed and will continue to change. And so for those that are coming, and I had written all these different principles, and one of the younger members of my team said, "Jacqueline, where's beauty?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Beauty." And he said, "Beauty is such a part of your leadership." And it really sent me on this introspective journey, Kelly, about the need for beauty, resilience, joy, sustenance, because this work does at times feel like it can break you. And this story is not in the book, but I think when I really saw that most powerfully was after a very, very long day in the Mathari Valley slum, which is a very rough slum, and certainly was 30 years ago, in outside of Nairobi, Kenya. I had seen horrendous things that week. And that particular day, I was speaking to all these different women whose lives were full of tragedy and despair and loss and lack of income. And we were almost overwhelmed as we were trying to find ways for them to generate more income. And at the very end of the day, when I was about to leave, I got in my little tiny car and the rains came and my car started sinking in the mud. And I thought, I'm not getting out of here. Mm. And it's a dangerous place to be in the day. It's a really dangerous place at night. And suddenly there was this tap on the window and a tiny woman beckoned me to follow her. And so I did, call it reckless, call it prescient. And we went down this little muddy alley and through this door, and inside this shack was a group of women, and they were dancing with abandon, with Coke can, you know, bottle caps on their wrists and shaking. And I jumped into the dancing. And as I got lost in that movement, I realized this is it. This is what we do as human beings when we're broken and fighting despair. And when life is too hard, we dance, we pray, we sing. And that moment, which ended up being a very long night, changed me in helping me understand that I am drawn into those places of human darkness, in part because that is where I find the light and the beauty of the human spirit and its fierce urge to resist and to persist.
That's the thing I connected to reading the book. Having gone through a tragedy recently, the places I went to sort of reclaim myself were poetry, literature, music, all these things that were incredibly beautiful. And then even this morning, like I was looking for a quote, and I found this Viktor Frankl quote, and I keep going back to Frankl, right? And I remember this from college of being like, this is an amazing individual who lived through, you know, just one of the ultimate tragedies.
Genocide.
Yeah, genocide, literally. And came out with I know the answer to this, which is love and meaning. And also the one of the interesting things about this book also is the characters you introduce us to. And there's many powerful figures, but the one we meet first is a young woman named Monique, who is the Deputy Secretary General of Rwanda's Central Bank. But more importantly, she is the niece of an enterprising nun that you worked with years earlier, whose name I can't pronounce. So I'm setting you right up to say that.
Well, thank you. Before I do, just let me acknowledge your tragedy. And I'm just really sorry for that. And I do find, it wouldn't surprise me if you also found that in enduring and finding ways to help others through, you also probably really are finding ways that you like yourself in new ways.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, right? It which I don't think I'd thought of in the way you just put it, but yeah, it's all in the sort of reclaiming and the idea, which is very present in this book, of we need a new narrative totally, but then individually we have those times when we have to find our new narrative.
And we have to reclaim our own humanity.
Yeah.
And the strength of our humanity. So Felicula is the woman's name.
Felicula.
Played a huge role, though I didn't know her that long. I had gone to Rwanda just a few months after women had for the first time in history gotten the right to open a bank account. Average income was $112 per year. So we were really talking about a barter economy starting to move to the next level, where women were considered on the same rank as women, as children, and the mentally disabled. And, but you know, I was a 25-year-old former banker and thought, let's build a bank. Mm-hmm. And so we did the first microfinance bank in the country. And a few months after we created that bank, as one of the first women parliamentarians, Felicula really led this policy change to abolish bride price, or the practice of paying a man for the hand of his daughter in marriage. And as so often elites do, miscalculated where the rest of her people were. There was a big backlash. Mm. A few weeks later, she was killed in a hit-and-run accident. And many people associate that death, her death, with that policy. And I was devastated, as you can imagine. But it was also the beginning of my starting to lose a bit of my idealism as I understood the price some people pay for rejecting the status quo. And then, speaking about being broken, mm-hmm. I left Rwanda a few years later, and a few years after that, the genocide exploded and not only killed many of the people I knew, but some of the people I worked with also were part of planning the genocide. Cool. And having to confront truly the monsters and angels that exist in all of us, there were times when I thought, what was all this work from so many people for? What did it amount to? And so now you fast forward 30 years, I'm standing in Kigali. Now I'm back to propose this $70 million impact fund to electrify the homes of 10 million East African low-income people. And this woman, as you said, Monique, walks up to me and says, I think you knew my auntie. And I said, really, what's her name? And she said, Felicula. And I burst into tears. I turned to the president and his ministers and I tell the story. Mm. And I said, you know, had you told me when we were first starting that within a single generation, a woman would be at the top of the financial sector, I'm not sure I would have believed you. And maybe our dreams were too small. And that was the moment where I realized maybe I was back in that very same place 30 years later to continue work that Felicula had started and couldn't complete in her lifetime. And that it was to me to recommit to the dreams I had that I might not fulfill in mine.
So literally this is around mid-80s, right? When
86 is when I first got there.
Wow.
86.
Yeah. Okay. And you mentioned microfinancing, and I don't know much about it. And I think that our listeners probably could use a primer in what exactly is microfinancing.
So in short, it's premised on the fact that, you know, low-income people have no collateral and money lenders take advantage of that and will tend to lend at 10% per day often.
Yeah.
Think of payday lending in the United States as well, 300% per year. And so Muhammad Yunus in 1976, who ended up getting the Nobel laureate for this insight, understood that while poor people might not have tangible collateral, they have each other. They have solidarity. And so if you could get a group of five people to guarantee each other, you could give each individual a tiny loan, $30 to start. And the group would be responsible for that individual repaying. And if they didn't, the whole group wouldn't get their next loan, and, you know, as individual loans. And so it really took off like wildfire. It's a $40 billion industry now. This was early days.
Yeah.
And we had started this microfinance bank having not a clue what we were doing, but being undaunted and really did see the power, even Kelly, of seeing low-income women and saying, I believe in you. I know you can make use of this, and we're in this together. And that was the beginning of my understanding that access to markets is a form of freedom, mm-hmm. but more important, helping people utilize that access is a form of power.
And that was that first company was Didrumbir. Is that?
I'm sorry for all, every name in my life is not easy.
Duterembere.
It means Duterembere.
Oh,
it means to go forward with enthusiasm.
Oh, okay, great. I'm glad one word can express that. I just can't say it. And so I'm going to ask you for one more term, which is patient capital.
So in some ways, as you said, this book, who knew it would land in the middle of a pandemic?
Yep.
Patient capital makes a lot more sense today than it did 20 years ago when I first pioneered it with Acumen. Rather than making short-term investments and focusing on getting money back as my first and foremost priority, patient capital recognizes that when you are trying to solve a problem of poverty or any intractable problem, there is no roadmap. Otherwise, it would be solved. And so those entrepreneurs require long-term patient investing so that we could use the discipline that markets ask for without destroying the entrepreneur along the way and the company. So we make 10 to 15 year equity investments and loans in entrepreneurs that are trying to solve healthcare, energy, education, agriculture for people making just a couple of dollars, a few dollars a day. We accompany those entrepreneurs with a lot of talent support and with connections and networks. And when they give us money back, they pay us back, we reinvest it in other innovation for the poor.
So I've interviewed a lot of people. There's just been a lot about the future of work and a lot about the economy and a lot about capitalism. These are not areas that I normally find myself reading into, but have lately. And it strikes me what a lot of the different folks are saying, and some of them are academics and some of them are entrepreneurs and CEOs, is that we have to reimagine capitalism. We have to reimagine, especially shareholder capitalism, this idea of purpose over profit. And what the social scientist tells us with this is like, of course you're going to err to the side of take more, because that's what human beings do. We have all the, this is a fascinating thing, we have things like seatbelts, which were like, everyone, you know, totally gets it. And yet we don't have seatbelts for the rich to not take too much. And this moral revolution that you talk about, it's really sort of an audacious vision of the future where people are looking towards our connected selves as opposed to just our individual selves, right?
Right, our consuming selves.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, when you and I were growing up, the world was, as probably all, you know, older generations say, you know, it was simpler then, but everything was divided. You had communism, capitalism, for-profit, non-profit, gender. There was we saw the world in separation, mm-hmm. Different religions. Mm-hmm. And then the Berlin Wall fell down and the technology revolution started. And you saw this acceleration of those ideas. Suddenly freedom, the individual, in a way it was a response to the generation that came before.
Yeah.
And before we knew it, the individual freedom, shareholder capitalism was raised to the rank of religion. Right. And our ideology and our definition of success was money, fat, pay, fame, and power. Mm-hmm. And Plato says that a country cultivates what it honors.
Hmm.
And suddenly, not just the United States, but countries around the world were honoring money, power, fame, the rise of the individual, the entrepreneur hero. And suddenly we hit a wall of individualism, consumerism, selfishness, inequality, divisiveness, and the same forces of capitalism and technology, which have set the world free, also have within them the power to destroy us.
You write somewhere in the book, I think it's the line, I don't have it in front of me, which is something like, we're always becoming. And I think this is so important, especially in a time like this, where many of us are looking at our own culpability inside various structures, whether it's, you know, white supremacist structures that we've worked in and sometimes even led, and what we could have done. And you do a lot of telling on yourself in the book, which I really appreciate. But there's a really telling story when you're meeting a new Acumen fellow in Bandra, I believe, India, at a coffee shop. And you're waiting for him. He's late. But then you get up to go look for him, right? Tell that story, if you would.
So Vimal Kumar, who's an extraordinary human being, we had just accepted a fellow from the scavenger caste in India. For non-Indians, the scavenger caste is the lowest caste within the caste system of the Dalits, or what used to be called the untouchables. Scavengers have been consigned for many generations to pick up human waste from latrines, from the streets, often with pieces of cardboard or plastic. And I knew that Vimal was leading a movement for scavenger rights. I also knew that he was working on his PhD. And I was like, who is this young man? Before I meet all the fellows, I want to meet Vimal. And so I invited him on a Sunday afternoon, hot Mumbai day, and at this coffee shop. And as you said, I'm sitting inside. I'd had meetings all day. I just booked myself. And my previous meeting had left, and the hour hits, and there's no Vimal. And I think, that doesn't really make sense, given that I'm the CEO, just from just an analysis of power type of thing, yeah. Who this young man probably is. And then a couple of minutes go by, and then I get this pit in my stomach, and I think, oh, please, please, no, 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 no. He doesn't want to come into the restaurant without me. And maybe I'm wrong. And I walk outside, and there he is standing, you know, drenched in sweat with a big smile on his face. And I felt so ashamed. It's like, I should know better. And so I just hugged him. Mm-hmm. To be like, welcome, and I'm so sorry, come on in, and let me get you something to drink or eat, and there's all these croissants and sandwiches, what do you want? And he was like, just water. And I was like, seriously? And I did push.
Yeah.
But I still left it his choice. And so then we had just one of the most remarkable conversations of my life. And we left. And about a year later, I saw him again. And he had changed so much. And we started talking about the first time that we met. And he said, you know, you were the first person to ever just touch me outside my caste. And you hugged me. Instead of interrogating me as a stranger, you welcomed me as a friend. And that was a gift. And I was like, yeah, but you wouldn't even let me buy you anything. And he said, well, Jacqueline, I was afraid to come into the restaurant because if you weren't there, they would expect me to buy something and I had no money in my pocket. And then I didn't want you to get me anything because what if you asked me to split the bill? Hmm. And again, Kelly, I thought, I've been doing this stuff for decades.
Sure.
And I still messed up.
Yeah.
Vimal will always be one of my greatest teachers. I just interviewed him and he's been in Washington. And so to hear an analysis of Black Lives Matter from the perspective of an Indian Dalit who wrote a searing piece on what it means to be untouchable in the age of COVID is one of the big gifts in my life. Just try to wrap your head around that,
yeah.
Right? We won't come near you in good times, but in COVID, we want you to do our garbage, pick up our waste, carry our dead. Mm-hmm. And there are many parallels when you look at the migrant workers in the United States who were fully unseen, invisible, and persecuted in the time of COVID suddenly became essential.
Right, right.
And how do you make the invisible, not just visible, but valued?
And you write the book that listening is a lifelong process, and that's what this is. I mean, look, this has been my work for 30 plus years is incredibly being others focused and listening deeply, and the shit I've missed is just overwhelming. But the fact is, it's like the tension that you hold with that, that's where the good stuff is, because that can allow you to empathize but with action, because you like, I do it too, we all do it.
You're so right. And that's also where I think forgiveness is and humility comes in. Mm. Because, yes, you've missed a lot. But if you've been listening deeply for 30 years, there's a lot you don't miss. And so when I miss, and I still miss, and I want to kick myself in the head, the acknowledgement that I missed it, no matter how late it is, when I feel I want to just tell that person that I missed it, what do I learn from it? And then can I forgive myself for it? I think keeps me humble, but it also, some of the times the young people on the team will tease me about being a witch. We'll sit and be like, how'd you know all that? And I was like, I was listening, just not with my ears. And they're like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, didn't you see that guy and how nervous he was? Didn't you see her and the way that she just kept looking at herself rather than in her reflection of the phone, rather than the person she was supposed to be talking to? She's telling us who she is, just not with her words. And so my bet is that you have not missed a lot also.
Mm. So there's three schools of improvisation, essentially. There's the Spolin school, which Second City comes from, which has concepts like follow the follower, which I've talked a lot in this podcast, which is a leadership idea where you're constantly trading off leadership. It's very Peter Drucker sort of associated. And then there's Keith Johnstone, who's a Brit who did most of his work in Canada, who has a lovely sort of phrase about walking backwards into the future. Which I think is a great way.
Love that. Yeah, I feel like I do that half the time.
Yeah. Hopefully we all do. And then there's Augusto Boal, who was a real social justice theater of the oppressed guy in Brazil. And he talks a lot about accompaniment, which you also talk about in the book. And even you say, quote, it is to be a follower as well as a guide. And I feel like that ties together all those three schools, that particular idea, which really is about, that's a Jesuit idea, right?
It's a Jesuit. I was going to say, if he's from Brazil, he probably had a Jesuit in his life.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit, because I feel like that in the book itself, that's kind of this turning point, as we would call a run out in our show, where you're leading up to the end and your call for action in terms of, this is ours to do together.
This is ours to do together. And again, I've always naturally accompanied, but I didn't integrate it into my organization until, you know, after I'd made a lot of mistakes. And I think that may have been in part because while I was being very courageous, I thought, in reimagining capitalism and the way that financial markets could work, I still was using some of the language and constructs of the financial sector. So we had a whole post-investment policy where we would make an investment and we would make sure those investments worked and we'd check in on them and we were very accountable. We weren't always as generous as we needed to be in terms of actually walking with our entrepreneurs, particularly when they didn't have the kind of access, privilege, networks, confidence, language that we did, just by virtue of the fact that we've been around a long time and we have a lot of connected people in our network and our community. And so I started to think about how I have practiced accompaniment in other parts of my life, and I needed to bring it courageously and fearlessly into an investing organization and use the language of it. So as you said, it's a Jesuit term that means to walk alongside. I'll hold a mirror to you. I'll help you see your potential sometimes more than you see it yourself. And I will take the problem on with you, but I can't solve it for you. At Acumen, we talk about the one-armed hug. You got to build those muscles, and I will help you so that you can solve all other problems that come your way. And what's been so exciting to me is when we started really practicing it inside Acumen, my organization, we realized that to help make our companies succeed, we had to be in the problem with them. Build that kind of trust so that the problem didn't get out of hand before we could actually help the entrepreneur solve it. And that was a big part of patient capital investing. When you look at D-Light, which has now reached 100 million people with off-grid light and electricity, it was the patient capital. Yes, it was also putting 12 fellows for a year each to bring very sophisticated talent into helping them build. Yes, it was sitting on their board and feeling responsible for their success, even as we were their investor and they were repaying us. And that meant we also got to celebrate the great victories and go through some pretty hard, hard times. So when I think about our broken healthcare systems and the possibilities of hiring residents to work with other residents to deal with what really ails us, then the conversation around how we make ourselves healthier as a nation moves away from the diametric of nationalized health insurance or business as usual, which is important. I believe everyone deserves and requires health insurance, but that's not going to make us healthy. That may keep us from dying, but what will make us healthy is better schools, better criminal justice, the way we eat, reducing chronic stress and hypertension.
Climate.
And so if we could hire local residents to be companions, help you shop, go on walks, more likely, and we're seeing models like this, you'll stay out of the hospital. Hospitals are less burdened. Patients are healthier. The workers, the healthcare workers, also get healthier and they get to contribute. And then you think about the opioid crisis, the criminal justice crisis. Our prisoners come out of jail with $5 and a Metro card. Good luck. That is not a system for success. But if we could hire other Americans to meet them at the prison door and help them reintegrate, we'd all be a lot healthier, more bonded, less individualistic, and more aware of the systems that, I mean, frankly, we're all a part of. You know, we are that system. We can change that system.
Yeah, and it's going to require a lot of us.
a lot.
and I will say, just speaking of those of us who tilt to the left, as everyone knows I do, we have a lot of growing up to do in this area as well. I just interviewed a few weeks ago, it hasn't aired yet, a podcast with Irshad Manji, who's a queer, gay Muslim woman.
I know Irshad.
You know, yeah. So she spent a lifetime yelling about things on networks, and she had a real sort of awakening that maybe we need to stop. Maybe we need to stop labeling each other and actually listen to each other.
God bless her.
Yeah, and maybe we need to. And she has a neighbor named Jim, who's a Trump voter, who also introduced her to her future wife. You write in the book, quote, "You must be open to change and learning if you expect the other side to be the same." This isn't a thing I'm seeing us doing a lot right now in terms of the people that are in my echo chamber. And again, I think the term cancel culture is being overused. I think there's also a corrective that's just going on that should be taking place. But this is a hard one right now, right? This way of staying in the moment with someone who you see as a existential threat to you, even though maybe their vote is, but maybe it isn't. I don't know. Talk to me a little bit about that before, and then I'm going to ask you for your yes and story.
Well, you have just come right into, I literally got off the phone with a young person on my team who's so brilliant and came here to your podcast talking about just this. Mm-hmm. I'm very worried about this country. Remember, I lived in a place that was full of harmony and seen as the pinnacle of success on the African continent. And then there was a genocide. And I watched fear and insecurity grow. And I think where we really underestimate this kind of language is that what I learned in Rwanda, as I said before, is that monsters and angels exist in all of us. Mm-hmm. Those monsters are just proxy for our broken parts, our fears, our insecurities. And in times like this, when we are surrounded by uncertainty, it gets really easy, not just for demagogues, but for social media, which in and of itself doesn't have a conscience, to prey on those broken parts. And that can lead to really terrible things. So I'm definitely paying close attention to what is happening on left and right. And we're losing the opportunity to really recognize that we have more resources, knowledge, and understanding of each other than ever in history.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing in our leaders and often in ourselves is people shouting from one corner of the other. And that's, again, when I use the word moral, it doesn't come from a place of righteous nor some set of rules prescribed by some higher authority. It is really the courage to navigate between competing belief systems, make principled choices, but gain trust because you do it on behalf of others, not yourself. And so the tools that we've been developing, I mean, they sound so simple, but they're so hard to do, which is that when you're confronted with real difference, acknowledge a truth or even a partial truth in what the other side says. Take a figurative step forward to allow for a field of possibility. One of my favorite quotes is by the Sufi poet Rumi, who says, "Beyond right doing and wrongdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there."
Mm.
And this is the practice. I think this is the work. I've spent the last 13 mornings from 6 a.m. till between 10:30 and 11 a.m. Working with first 20 Bangladesh fellows and then 20 Indian fellows. And I said to both groups that, you know, when I think about who's in the Acumen community, because we include people from the lowest castes, Indians, Muslims, Christians, atheists, and many, many other religions, people of every color, people of every class. We have some of the wealthiest people on the planet and literally some of the poorest, people from slums, people from rural areas, yet people who were raised to hate each other.
Yeah.
And we put them in a room, but not for a split second and a few hundred characters on social media. And we keep them in the room and we have hard conversations about trade-offs, about choices, about power, and about getting stuff done. And inevitably there will be a moment where someone says, "Your father fought in the military that killed my family in my tribal community." And it's like, yeah, that's our reality, guys. So now what's next?
Yeah. Yeah. I was having this conversation with a friend of mine who was reminding me of Cal Newport, who wrote the book Deep Work, and this idea.
I remember Deep Work.
Yeah, right. And this idea of like, well, let's actually take some time. And then I just, one of my next podcasts is with this Harvard professor, Joseph Badaracco, who has a book called Step Back, which is all about the art of reflection. And so this idea of, and one of his first things he says is, stop looking for perfect reflection. Like just find the moments throughout the day when you can have imperfect reflection, if that's what it is. But find the time to carve out those moments. And I was doing a talk recently where a gentleman works at Kellogg. I think he used to run Baxter or some of the pharma. But he was talking about, you know, I said how I work out every day. That is a thing that I do. And he's like, a lot of people say to him, "I wish I had the time to work out." And he's like, "It's not that you don't have the time. It's that you've chosen not to do that thing." I mean, there's the clock is the clock and the calendar is the calendar and we all make our priorities and that's fine. I'm not here to judge you. But the especially with the overwhelming amount of data we have right now, the amount of noise that's coming from our social media, not to mention a global pandemic and a Black Lives Matter revolution that
I'm and potentially a global depression coming up.
Yes, global depression coming up. That I think it demands of us to slow down and to take our moments and again that the work happens over that longer period. And I'm not talking like I'm not saying that everything has to take 10, 20 years. But just take, because the science is pretty clear on this. When we take the time to be with others, our tolerance increases, our empathy increases, and we can begin to find this path forward together. And you see that even now with this Black Lives Matter movement, where the polling is like, most people are like with this thing, right? I mean, of both parties, this is not
both parties.
This is like the gay marriage thing, where it was just sort of like, oh my God, we all had. I say it's because I've worked in comedy my whole life. There's no sweeter moment than unified laughter in a moment, especially when you know that line is coming and you know everyone is going to laugh at the same time, because it's a little tiny miracle that, like, how are you reaching all these people? But I feel like that's kind of what this is, too.
I love that. Have you ever seen the laughing circles in India, Kelly?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love that. But what you're saying is it's change. You know, in 2007, when we invested in these two guys with their $30 light and this dream to eradicate kerosene, with which 1.5 billion people were using every day, killing themselves, killing the planet, and costing a lot of money, a part of me was like, well, this is an interesting experiment that we're going to have. And there, in years 5, 6, and 7, it felt really long.
Yeah.
But suddenly, when you're at year 10, 11, 12, and not only have 100 million people had their lives fundamentally changed,
yeah,
fundamentally changed, but you have seen this company catalyze an energy revolution that could help not only cure energy poverty, but help avert long-term climate crisis and truly free women, open up economic possibility. Then 10 years looking backward, that goes like that. It's looking forward that it sounds long.
Yep, yep. All right. We always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they get nowhere by saying no. And they actually don't get very far just by saying yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
Well, I have about 1,000 yes and stories, because it's the only way that we actually can do our work.
Yeah.
And I love Second City, by the way, and I love the idea of improv and comedy, and I wish I were funny, which I am not, but I really appreciate funny. The value of holding opposite values and beliefs and even truth's intention is one of the key principles of the book. And so yes and is a principle by which we live in doing this work. And since you started with capitalism, and so many people think we need to throw capitalism overboard, let me do a yes and on capitalism. So, capitalism is full of extraordinary potential and power to enable innovation and prosperity. And it is full of deep peril to allow for exclusion and exploitation. And for those who see the sole purpose of business as profit, this is a very uncomfortable yes and. And for those who have no trust in business at all, this is a very uncomfortable yes and. But if you stand on one side or the other, you negate the potential creative and generative capacity of learning to use the power of markets without being controlled by them.
Love it. The book is called Manifesto for a Moral Revolution, Practices to Build a Better World. Jacqueline Novogratz, thank you for coming on the show.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
one survives.